godly family look like? What does a godly family look like? The first law of success, we've always understood, is to have the right goal. And that right goal in every aspect of life is, first of all, to do God's will, of course. I will assume we know that and move on to marriage. Because the first law of having a successful marriage and family is to be able to see the goal as God sees it. And too often in today's world, young people grow up without being taught anything about that goal. And when I say today's world, that applies all the way back to when we were growing up, probably, those of us my age and older, because most of us really didn't get a whole lot of instruction about what we were doing and why we did it. It was just sort of doing what came naturally. Added to that is the problem, especially today, of so few role models of good marriage. And we've learned that even some of those we thought were good role models in days of old were not really behind the scenes good role models at all. It was only their public persona that carried that, but at least that had some value. So what do I mean? What does a godly marriage look like? Most of us know that a pickup truck, a Cadillac convertible, and a smart car look very different. They're three entirely different animals, if we want to look at it that way. You have to know what your purpose for the vehicle is before you go out and buy it. And you have to know what marriage is before you marry. Now, some of us, most of us in this room, are sitting here saying, too late. Too late. I've been married a good long while. So I will add, or you have to learn to make the best of the choice you made. You have to drive what you bought. In short, we have to learn after the fact and still make the best of the situation and learn to do it God's way. Now, I adapted this sermon today from material I will be giving in the marriage class at Foundation Institute this week, but that is a 5-hour course. And so I tried to condense some things into a 1-hour course to pass on to you today. And of course, in Ambassador College, when I taught the class in marriage and family in the 1980s, it was a semester-long course. So we've taken a semester course, condensed it to 5 hours for FI, and I'm trying to condense it to 1 hour for you, which means, of course, you're going to leave a lot of things out. So I'm just going to try to give you some principles and an overview here. And of course, most of us are already married, though there are teenagers and others among us who will be looking at that choice sometime in the not too distant future. But when I was asked to teach that class, I was asked to help young people understand what a godly family looks like. And of course, many of them have not grown up in one. Even though they're now at FI, they have not grown up necessarily in a godly family where people understood before marriage, into marriage, and through child rearing exactly how the family should function. When I say exactly, I mean in terms of spiritual principles. But what a godly family looks like can only be defined by God, and we will discover some of those answers in the scriptures. And again, over a 5-hour course, we would discover several more than we will today. But before we get into those mechanics of how to build a good, strong marriage and family, we need to look at the goal and contemplate what a godly family does look like. So the simple answer would be easy, wouldn't it? I could give you one line and walk off. A simple answer would be that a godly family looks as much like God as possible. Okay, is that enough? It looks as much like God as possible, but of course we need some more detail. To answer the question, we need to examine a few passages of the scripture and keep them clearly in mind, and then I'll try to give you a series of points to ponder on this subject. Let's go first to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. We have long understood that this passage in Ephesians chapter 5 is sort of the spiritual foundation of our understanding of marriage and shows us that there is a spiritual foundation for marriage and that we need to be aware that God is involved. In fact, my entire first class, or not entire first class, but a good part of the first class at the FI class will be helping them understand that marriage comes from God and it's God who has the authority over it, and it is God to whom we must look for the instruction, the direction, if we're going to make marriage what it ought to be in God's eyes. We haven't taken time for that here, but it's pretty obvious for all of us, even here in this, in these passages. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 5 and begin with verse 18 first, which comes a little before the headline on marriage. Verse 18, "And do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord." So there's an attitude of mind and a way of life here that puts God first. "Giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, submitting to one another in the fear of God." Now, I could give you a whole sermon probably on that line right there. Submitting to one another in the fear of God. That has to do with us as Christians. It has to do with us as mates. It has to do with whole family context. It has to do with the congregation. Submitting to one another in the fear of God. And then he launches into the marriage subject specifically. Verse 22, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord." A lot of men can quote that verse, and they don't have a clue what comes afterward. You know, this verse is a critical verse, but it is not the whole story, is it? It's very important for both husbands and wives, and particularly for wives in terms of their own responsibility, but it isn't the whole story. "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord." That's a pretty big order. That's a pretty big order to say, I'm going to be able to submit to my husband as I would submit to Christ. If we're really converted and submissive to Christ, we understand what that means, and we're constantly trying to perfect it and improve it. And if we are doing that, then we recognize that to submit ourselves to a human being in a similar manner is a huge responsibility and challenge. And then it goes on in verse 23, "For the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he," that is Christ, "is the Savior of the body." Likewise, obviously, the husband is intended to be the savior of the body in the physical sense of protecting and defending his wife and caring for her and comforting her and doing what she needs, not just what he needs. Verse 24, "Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ," growing in that subjection, we hope, to Christ, "so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything." Then verse 25, "Husbands," comes our turn. "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So ought husbands to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself." Let's take that whole passage for a moment to look at it. It says husbands should love their wives as Christ loves the church. Again, a huge responsibility and virtually impossible task for a human being. How are we going to be Christ-like in the way we love somebody? Of course, only with God's Spirit, God's knowledge, are we going to even begin to approach that process. But it is a responsibility that Paul, through Christ's inspiration, lays on us. I don't attribute it just to the Apostle Paul, but to God himself, who's laid this out, because Paul obviously understands that there's a spiritual connection between marriage, which many of us participate in and enjoy, and the spiritual relationship with Christ and the spiritual relationship the church has with Christ and ultimately with God the Father. And Christ, it says here, gave himself for the church in verse 25. He gave himself for her. So again, that fits in with what it says up in verse 23, that he is the Savior of the body. Christ gave himself for the church. Then it goes on and says that he might sanctify and cleanse her, and it talks about him washing and ironing, in a sense, to get out the spots and wrinkles in the church. And again, some husbands would like to look at it that way and say, well, that means I get to tell my wife exactly how to live, and I am her judge in terms of how she functions and how she obeys God, how she obeys Christ, by the way that she obeys me. Now, while there is some spiritual truth in the fact that her judgment is going to be based partly on how she submits to her husband and how she interacts with and loves her husband, we are not Christ in the sense of being able to wash and iron and get out the spots and wrinkles of our mate. We can ask God to do that, and we can encourage our mate to do that, but we don't have the perfection that Christ has. You see, Christ is bringing the church to a level to marry him. Christ is the bridegroom. The church is the bride. Christ is preparing the bride so that she is on an equal footing and compatible with Christ when they finally get married, which happens when Christ returns. So we're in a little different place, guys, in terms of teaching our wives exactly how they should live in relationship to us. We can help them, we can encourage them, we can influence them, we can guide them perhaps sometimes, but they have a relationship with Christ himself, and they have a relationship with us that they must work out, and they must learn and grow in. And it's a combination of all of us working together. So the husband is loving his wife, the wife is submitting to the husband, and of course she's loving him as well. And if you remember, I read in verse 21, submitting yourselves one to another. There's a time in the marriage when, in an indirect sense at least, we are submitting one to another, where the man is listening to his wife, taking good counsel, understanding what her position is, and then saying, yes, you're right, let's do it that way. You know, that's an act of submission, in a sense, on the husband's part, where he's not saying, no, I'm in charge, I see it this way, I'll do it this way, you can take it or leave it. There's a time when it's good to get the counsel and the advice from the other side of the table and then say, you know, I hadn't seen it that way. You're right. I think we can do it and come out ahead by doing it more the way you're doing it than the way I wanted to do it. And I would call that at least mentally and attitudinally an act of submission. All right, going on down, verse 28, we'll read again. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. Remember, we're one flesh when we become married. We are no longer two separate people, going our separate ways, living our separate lives, crossing paths now and then. I remember way back, I think when I was teaching at the college perhaps, the president of Braniff Airlines lived in Dallas, of course, where Braniff was based, and his wife lived in New York. And they said they managed to get together, because he had an airline, they managed to get together a couple of times a month. And that was their marriage. And, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine that you enter into a marriage with that kind of a relationship that is basically long distance and not an ongoing day-to-day interaction and caring for and helping and serving and loving one another in the way that we think of marriage. But that's what they did. Whether that marriage lasted or not, I can't tell you. I didn't follow up on that. Verse 29, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it. He says that because we are one flesh. Once you become one flesh, then it is your own flesh when you deal with your mate. Just as the Lord does the church. So Christ nourishes and cherishes the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. So we have to act like he acts. We think like he thinks. We do what he does. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. He's quoting Genesis 3 here when he says this. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Sorry, that's Genesis 2. I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Now again, he says, I speak concerning Christ and the church. So Paul elevates the entire subject of marriage to a type or an analogy of the relationship between Christ and the church. So there is a huge spiritual lesson to be learned in the process of marriage, in the way that we live, in the way that we treat one another, in what we learn by our interactions with one another. A huge spiritual laboratory, if you will, in which we learn a great deal about ourselves and about God. These are the spiritual underpinnings of our entire understanding of what marriage is. A marriage is a relationship between Christ and the church, and if we are going to represent that relationship, then we must do our best to live life between husband and wife as we would hope and see that Christ, in fact, loves and cherishes the church. You cannot, men, change your wives to conform to your own image. She is not you. She was not genetically you. She is not raised the same way you were, or educated the same way you are, might not have anything like your personality, but you were attracted to each other and you married. And if you wanted to change somebody, you should have found somebody that was a whole lot more like you before you married, so that it wouldn't have been such a tough job. if you marry somebody who's not like you, you cannot expect to conform them to your image, or even your image of what you think they should be. We haven't paid the price for that privilege as Christ did when he gave his life for the church. The bride will be compatible with Christ. We're all being washed and changed and perfected so that we can be compatible with Christ. And that, of course, is the ideal arrangement on the physical level for both. Husband and wife should be compatible as much as possible before marriage, and then they grow more compatible through time. We all know the stories about the older couples that we claim even look alike. You know, they've gotten more and more alike until they even look alike. And there probably is some truth in that to some degree. How that works, I don't know. God probably created that process. But at any rate, we do get more alike as time goes by. If we are compatible, if we spend our lives together peacefully and constructively, with only occasional setbacks that happen in almost every marriage, then we are going to grow, and we're going to grow to be more alike in the way we think, the way we function, what we understand about each other. We're simply going to become more compatible. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 3. As I said, I'm going to just give us a few quick underlying scriptures. 1 Peter chapter 3. And again, we will begin in verse 9, but that isn't the whole story. Sorry, verse 1. I don't mean verse 9. We'll finish in verse 9. But verse 1. 1 Peter 3, verse 1. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands. Now, here's a different apostle. This is Peter, not Paul. Peter saying the same thing. Wives, be submissive to your husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, that is, if they're not really obeying God and they're not really converted and living by the Bible, they, without a word, that is, without your word or preaching to them, may be won by the conduct of their wives. So there is such an example set and an approach to the marriage that the husband can actually be converted, if you will, or at least convicted of what is right by the actions of the wife. When, what's it say? When they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear, and that word fear is basically a word for respect and appreciation. It isn't a terror in that sense. There is a word for that. This is a respect and a proper submission to authority, that is fear, as we fear God, for example. Then he says to the women, do not let your adornment be merely outward. I appreciate that addition in the New King James, because in the Old King James you could read over this and think you're not supposed to take care of yourself in any kind of makeup or jewelry or hairstyle or whatever fashion at all. Because it says, do not let your adornment be. But this says, do not let it be merely, which is really the intent of the scripture here. Don't let it be just the physical things you do for an outward appearance. Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel, all of which are acceptable. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart. So the true adornment is inside. Remember, God said, man looks on the outward appearance, but I look on the heart. So God says, okay, you can go ahead and make yourself look beautiful, and that's terrific and wonderful, and most men appreciate that. But what's really important is what's inside, which is the true adornment, where the true jewelry is, which is the pearl of great price, the truth of God embedded in your life. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. See, this is incorruptible beauty. How many times have those of us who are married had our wives say, when we got out of the car on the way into church on a gusty day, oh, there goes my hair. Right? That's what happens. It's corruptible. You can't keep it. I mean, you might plaster it down heavily enough or somehow fix it so that it's not corruptible, but in most cases, it's corruptible. You know, your skirt gets wrinkled. We used to travel long distances between churches, sometimes 4.5 hours between churches. My wife was always looking for clothing that didn't look like it just came out of the washer, wadded up, and wrung out when she ended up at the end of 4.5 hours. It's corruptible. So your clothing, your hair, your jewelry, you know, we've even had that happen. All of a sudden, a little gem falls out of the pin on your dress or whatever. It's all corruptible is the point. He says, these things are incorruptible. It's an incorruptible beauty of the gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and of course that's a different word than the Christ. This is a master, which he was, whose daughters you are if you do good or well, in the old King James, and are not afraid with any terror. You're not terrified and treating him like he's God, but you are doing well and respecting and submitting to a husband. He goes on then, of course, naturally, and must go on to verse 7, husbands likewise. So take the principles that are included already here, men. It isn't, this is all for the wives, now we start the men, but the whole thing is for all of us. Because again, there is the inward part that has to be considered. With the woman, it's a meek and quiet spirit. With the husband, it's an attitude of outgoing concern and love that protects and defends. Verse 7, husbands likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel. Now, we live in a society that doesn't like that terminology. I think it's relatively clear to everybody, but even that is not appreciated by some, that this is a reference to a physical situation, the fact that most men can overpower and abuse most women. Of course, we have in our society crazy situations where we have males abused by females, but for the most part, this is talking about women being the weaker vessel in the physical sense of the capacity to engage in warfare with a man. But that is not the real issue, is it? The next line is, as being heirs together of the grace of life. You're one flesh and heirs together of the grace of life. Whatever God is doing with one of you, he can do with both. I'm not going to go there right now, but he even says in 1 Corinthians that, you know, the unbelieving mate is sanctified by the believing mate. So there's even a blessing from God for the individual who is not converted, but who gives himself into a relationship with a covenant in marriage in such a way that God will bless the family. Heirs together the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. So the way we conduct ourselves in marriage, it says here, if I'm reading this correctly, and I certainly think I am reading it correctly, it says here that if we're conducting ourselves correctly in marriage, our prayers have free access to God. If we're not doing that, our prayers are hindered. We could spend a sermon on that, talking about God saying, God's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, but your sins have separated you from God so that he will not hear. Right? His ear is not heavy. He just won't hear you because of your sin. So he says here, we can hinder our prayers even by the way we treat each other in marriage. Now, if we're really Christians and trying to do what God intends for us to do and accomplish God's will, then we certainly don't want our prayers hindered, do we? Verse 8 gives us some specifics. Finally, all of you, and again, this is to the congregation, but it applies to this marriage discussion he's been giving us. All of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another, love as brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling. Some folks in the past, and I've been doing this a long time now, in my 47 years in the full-time ministry, I've seen people who thought they could put on a certain front at church and it was perfectly fine to be abusive at home. It was okay to return evil for evil, reviling for reviling in the marriage, because after all, it's a marriage. That's a terribly faulty reasoning. I wouldn't revile another member at church. I wouldn't revile the ministry. I wouldn't revile another lady in church, but I don't have a problem reviling my wife or doing evil for evil. But on the contrary, blessing, that is, blessing each other, helping each other, encouraging each other, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. And I will leave the rest of that. But that's critical information. We're talking about a relationship founded on spiritual law and on the spirit of the law and the spirit of love which flows from God through Christ to us, through his Holy Spirit. The emphasis is spiritual. It's the attitude of mind, the love that exists, the outgoing concern for the mate. That's the point here. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is one of our main chapters on marriage, because it also discusses marriage, divorce, widowhood, remarriage, a number of things that become very important when you in your life as you become an adult and then live through adulthood. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, quote, we think this is a quote, things you wrote to me, quote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, end quote. They wrote that to Paul. It might be like the Pharisees talking to Christ, who said, well, then what's the point in getting married if all those rules apply? why even bother? And here they say it's good for a man not to touch a woman. And Paul says, no, there are times when that's right and true. He talks later about certain celibate situations. But he says here, it is good for a man, they say it's good for a man not to touch a woman. He says, no, nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, because it's a physical, natural action in the life of almost every human being, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. Now, if we had time to go back through all the material that's covered in the first few chapters of The Missing Dimension in Sex, we would have the background here to understand that there are great spiritual implications here about being one flesh and about how we treat one another. We don't have that, and we're not going to do that here. But he's saying it's a natural union, but a divine institution. We cover that very thoroughly in the classes, in the college, and in the Foundation Institute as well. There is a spiritual dimension here that has to be added. And so Paul is saying a physical, carnal, shall we put it that way, human, I only mean it by that, human, the natural fleshly being is a what the world calls a sexual being. There is a constant interaction with sexual matters. And so he says, because that is true, God made marriage and made male and female and put them together, and they need to be together. So let each woman have her own husband, let each man have his own wife, let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. So when you become one flesh, you not only should not be persecuting the other person because no man hated his own flesh, but you should in fact be caring for and loving the other person because you have authority over that body. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, talking about a marriage relationship, except for with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. So fasting and prayer seem to be, you know, a spiritual pursuit that is a temporary focus on something of a higher level is the only thing that allows us to withdraw from our mate. Come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Back to the same point he's making in verse 2 and 3. Again, we could spend a whole class on this point, and we won't do that. When we write marriage ceremonies, and I've written a couple of them for the church, one of the things that's always included, of course, is what is commonly called the wedding vows or the marriage vows. And that, of course, is the part in which we say things like, till death do us part, or in sickness and health, or for good or for better or for worse, or in hard times or easy times or good times or whatever. The wording varies in various church ceremonies, and certainly outside our congregation it does, but they always include some of those things. And so the wedding vows then themselves are a reflection of what God has already said, but they are specifics in which we can look and say, this is what I need to do to fulfill the relationship that I've taken on in marriage. One other thing we need to remember, Matthew, or maybe not just one, but Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. We go to this from time to time because it is so fundamental to everything we are and try to be as Christians. in this context, beginning verse 15, he's talking about false prophets, but then he goes on to talk about, in verse 16, you know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? And then in down in verse 20, he says, therefore, by their fruits you shall know them. So we're judged in that sense on many areas of our life by the fruits. What do we do? What do we produce? What is the visible evidence of how we're living our lives? And the fruits will come out. You cannot hide the truth. It will ultimately come out in the wash. And the strength of your marriage will show through in all that you do. Now, there are certainly times when one individual cannot fix it. It takes two. It takes two to marry. It takes two to stay together. It takes two to come apart. But sometimes you cannot do anything about that. And so the fruits then might not tell the whole story in the sense of what people can see, and it has to be explained and understood. We understand that. We know that. We've had many broken marriages in the church down through the years. But the point I'm making here is that the fruits are there, and God sees them, and God knows them, and the strength of your marriage will show. God sees, but so does man in that sense. So I'll come to another broad definition of the answer to what does a godly marriage look like. This one, instead of just saying it looks like God looks, maybe I'll say it a little differently. A godly marriage will reflect the scriptural instruction and the promises and commitments made at the marriage ceremony. So it's what God says plus what we committed to doing in whatever way the ceremony was worded when we did it, which in turn should have been thoroughly studied, discussed, and counseled about before marriage occurs. We don't have a lot of you in this room contemplating marriage, but some of you are free to do so. If you are contemplating marriage, it's a good idea to thoroughly study what it is, what it means. Make sure you have counseled with somebody capable of helping you to know what you're getting into, and that you are thoroughly acquainted with the potential mate. Again, in fulfilling God's law and the commitments you make, it's very helpful if you know a few things. I'll give you five. One, know what a family is. Know what a family is. And this is not just if you're about to get married. This is if you've been married 60 years. I use 60 because I don't think we have anybody present today who's reached that milestone. Yeah, maybe we do. But anyway, it doesn't matter how long you've been married. Know what a family is. Two, prepare yourself. And again, that's true certainly in advance of marriage, but it can be true throughout marriage. We're always preparing to try to live up to our responsibilities. Number three, seek wise counsel. And that too is both before and after marriage. Seek wise counsel. Many people enter into marriage without getting any counsel, even from family and friends. And four, understand the covenant you are making with God and your mate. Because a marriage covenant is a three-way covenant. It's a husband, a wife, and God. God created marriage. God binds marriage together. And so the covenant is a three-way covenant between the husband, the wife, and God. And number five, know that God will hold you responsible for keeping that covenant. Keeping your vows, we might say. God will hold you responsible for that. Now, with that background, I'd like to give you some points that you might consider as you talk and think about and pray about your own marriage. When I define a godly marriage, to the young people, for example, these are some of the elements that we try to include. What do we look at? What do we see? What do we find? What describes a godly marriage or a godly family? And remember, a marriage is a family. A family can have children added, but a marriage is a family even before children come along, because the two have become one flesh. What do we find? Number one, we find conversion. Now, we understand that there are marriages that take place where there may be a lack of conversion on the part of one individual, or even both individuals, because we sometimes do marry people who are not fully committed and converted. But if you are a believer, you need to marry a believer, because you will not be compatible with an unbeliever. You need to marry a believer because you will be compatible with a believer. Now, God has intervened in some of our cases and our circumstances and changed people's hearts and changed people's lives, and sometimes those who were unbelievers have become believers. We probably have a number of those cases right here in this congregation. It is also currently and has always been really a doctrine of the church that believers should marry believers. We covered this in the classes just this past week. We believe that that's what the Bible says through the Apostle Paul in chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, where we were reading earlier, that if a widow is going to marry, she can marry anybody she chooses that's free, only in the Lord, it says. So somebody who is committed to the same thing, because again, you're going to be one flesh walking the same road. And in almost all cases, by the way, as a matter of policy, just since we did cover it this week, just so you know, as a matter of policy, ministry in the church will not normally, and I say normally because there might be some rare exception where circumstances required it, but the ministry will not normally perform a wedding of a couple who are not spiritually on the same page, or what we might generally broadly define as believers. That does not necessarily always include a baptism. The converted married couple puts God first in their lives, knowing that everything else depends on that. So we find conversion in which there is a dedication to God and God's way. That means that if you looked at the family from a, you know, an outside perspective, if you had a hidden camera in the home, you would see some regular prayer and Bible study and occasional fasting. You would see individuals making provisions for each other's needs and providing time and space for those needs, whatever they might be. You would see an attitude in which one mate is not jealous of personal time spent with God. That is, you're always praying or studying. You never spend any time with me. You're always praying or studying. No, that's not, shouldn't happen anyway, really. I'm not saying you should be always praying and studying, and the other mate should just say, oh, well, he's being with God now. I'm saying that there should not be some kind of a critical judgment of necessary time spent in those things, such as praying and studying and doing the things that Christians have to do. In many cases, praying and studying will happen together. There's a certain approach to that that works well for some. Not everybody can do that, but some can. Both are faithful in their Christianity. They're faithful in church attendance. They're faithful in serving the brethren. They're doing whatever their talents and time allow them to do in serving God, serving the church. I won't take a lot of time here. We'll talk about this at another place in time. But, of course, we're all different personality-wise. There are introverts and extroverts and people who have been trained certain ways in terms of their manners or their lifestyle. And we all come together in this congregation, and we're very different. And each of us can bring something and add something, and we talked about that when we were talking about Ephesians 4 and the joints being fitly framed together by that which every joint supplies and so forth. So we're not saying that we all become exactly alike, but we live together in peace and harmony and mutual respect. Number two, they fully acknowledge that marriage is created by God. They fully acknowledge that marriage is created by God. That is, as we use the term, it is a divine institution. God makes the rules. A godly marriage will not happen unless the couple recognizes that God makes the rules. So they seek God's guidance for family decisions and for their lifestyle. They provoke each other to good works in appropriate roles. They put effort into encouraging each other and praising good works. See, there is an acknowledgement that marriage comes from God, and so we have to be godly in the way we treat one another. Number three, they respect the covenant. They respect the covenant. Both are fully aware of the covenant with God and each other that binds the marriage, and they are faithful to the conditions of that covenant. Doesn't matter how long we've been married, we have a responsibility to be faithful to the conditions of the covenant. God's conditions, as well as whatever additions we might have made when we pledged our love and took those vows, in a sense, before God and said, I do, in a marriage ceremony. But the covenant is with God, it binds the marriage, and we have a responsibility to be faithful to it. That means, for example, there is no time in marriage to revert to the single days. Now, I don't mean no time to be by yourself, we'll cover that. I mean no time to revert to the single days, no time to make decisions, judgments, take actions of various kinds that will affect the family without considering those effects. When you're single, especially if you're an adult that's independent of parents and you're single and maybe living alone and have your own job and your own income and you're an independent individual in that sense, you pretty much can do what you want. And even if you're a Christian doing what you want within God's law, you have a lot of freedom and you can call the shots. You can decide if you want to stay up late or go to bed early. You can decide if you want to eat out or eat in. You can decide how you want to spend your time. But once you're married, those decisions are going to have an effect on your mate and your children. And so you cannot revert to the single days and say, I'm just going to do it like I always did. You now have taken on a responsibility to love and care for other people. Now that emphatically does not mean, as I said, that you can't spend time alone, that you have to spend every free moment together. No, private time is okay. In fact, I know couples with whom private time is very important in the sense that they have to occasionally have their getaway, their isolation, their think time. It doesn't have to be a huge number of hours or days, perhaps. It might depend on the individual and the marriage, but some people are very comfortable spending a small amount of time away doing alternate things. I was counseling the other night, and there's a little example in Prepare and Enrich. And Prepare and Enrich is our outside marriage counseling system that we use, Prepare being prepare for marriage and Enrich being learn to enrich your marriage after you're married. And it gave an example that said, you know, I'm really concerned about our vacation coming up because I'd really like to go skiing, but I think you want to go to the beach. It's as simple as that, right? And maybe for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years, you wanted to go to the beach, but your mate always wants to go to the mountains. And somehow the mate always wins. So after a while, you get exasperated about not going to the beach. You can't let your mate get exasperated over something that you can fix, something that is simply a matter of agreeing to do something right. But there can be a time, perhaps, when one of you goes to the beach and the other to the mountains. That's pretty extreme in Texas. But there can be a time when one of you is doing one thing and the other is doing something else for a brief period of time apart. You don't have to spend your entire waking moments together. You didn't do that when you were dating and you were still in love, apparently. When you were dating, you had to take time alone and be apart for a period of time. And with mutual agreement, a lot of people need personal time with friends, other activities that are constructive and not detrimental to the relationship but may not be enjoyed by the mate. Some people have little traditions they do, like a boys' night out once a month or something, where the guys get together with friends and do something they consider masculine, go bowling or to the shooting range or play cards or whatever it is. And the girls maybe, and ladies tend to do things like this that men would never do, go together to the spa or, you know, go to an exercise program. Do something together that men consider unusual. Unusual to do together. Now, if it's a basketball game, that's going to the spa for us. The point is, these events never can be occasions to ignore your marital status or Christian behavior. And I've counseled with people who said, well, I just went out and had a cigar with my buddies. And they spit that out in defense of their actions. And then they go, oh, You know, I've actually had a guy say to me, well, I was just having a cigar with my buddies, and she got all upset. He thought I was going to say, well, that's no big deal. And of course, now I had two things to be concerned about. One, the fact that he didn't have a clue what his wife needed, and secondly, that he's out smoking a cigar as a break from his Christianity. Just taking a break. Just a boy's night out. All right, number four. Reminds me of a George Strait song, some of you know, some of you haven't heard, but there's a George Strait song called She Let Herself Go. If you haven't heard it, I won't ruin it for you. Point number four, both are growing in agape love. That is the Greek word for love, godly love. Both are growing in godly love. Now, you know, it might be expected that we would grow in marital love. We would grow in physical romantic love. But we ought to be growing in agape love even while we are participating in marital love, enjoying romantic love. There is a natural union, remember, and a divine institution. So while we're functioning within the natural union, we also must be learning the divine institution and recognizing that God is involved, and that true outgoing concern is the basis of a long-term successful marriage. Outgoing concern, not selfishness, not I'm getting everything I want and need out of this. Again, I've counseled scores of couples probably. I may be exaggerating, but it seems like scores. Maybe it's only dozens. Dozens of couples who say they're having problems, and when you get down to it, you find that one of them's perfectly happy in the relationship, and the other one's frustrated. Why? Because one of them's getting everything he or she wants. This is what I wanted out of marriage. I've got it. Sorry that you're unhappy. Duh. Can't work that way. They both have to be able to be happy and productive in marriage. They want the best for each other. They're willing to sacrifice personal wants and even personal needs, if necessary, if it will help the mate. Now, that's part of our responsibility of laying down our lives for our friends. We're probably not in the immediate future going to be called upon, like Abraham was, as we heard in the sermonette, to slay our son or to, you know, do some terrible thing to show God that we're faithful. We're given the opportunity every day in marriage to show God that we're faithful, that we're willing to lay down a little bit of our lives, to make a little bit of a sacrifice, to give up something I want or need in order to make my mate able to function better or just simply be happy or relieved of whatever stress or difficulty he or she might be facing. Number five. They accept the God-given roles. They accept the God-given roles of husband and wife and do not try to turn the relationship upside down. Now, what does that mean? Well, we read the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. The wife should submit herself to her husband. That's a relationship that God created, not the church. But there are lots of ways to work with that within the framework of our society without it being a king and a serf, without it being a tyrant, you know, and a person in bondage, a victim and a perpetrator. That's not the way it's supposed to be. Now, that all should be discussed, of course, before marriage, because different people and personalities are going to function in different ways. And some women are going to lean very heavily on their husbands and expect them to do basically everything, and they're going to be a submissive, quiet housewife. Other women are going to be strong, successful people who want to live their lives within both frameworks of being strong and culturally and socially involved, but still submissive to a husband's authority. Again, we're squeezing a lot into a small amount of time here, but the husband is always the leader and the final authority in the marriage, regardless of how everything else in their physical circumstance might work. And the wife is always submissive to her husband's authority. You don't alter that arrangement, even though the physical circumstances might appear pretty equalitarian, or egalitarian as the word properly is. Number six, the husband takes the lead. So five, they accept the God-given roles. Number six, the husband takes the lead in both spiritual and physical things. By physical things, we mean things like financial decisions, for example. But remember, men, Leadership is service. Taking the lead doesn't mean I make all the decisions and I win all the arguments. Taking the lead means leadership in service as well. So the man in leading is providing for his mate's needs and, of course, his children, if we're talking about a family with children. He must never neglect his wife to provide what he wants for himself. That's a kind of a test you can run on yourself from time to time. Am I neglecting my wife in order to provide what I want for myself? We haven't had any time together in 6 weeks, but I haven't been on the golf course that long either. And today I get to go play golf. She's crying, and I'm sorry about that. But I'm going to play golf. You never neglect your mate. It's the same with the wives, of course, but the husband is in the more of a position to do this because of being, quote, the leader. God holds you responsible for feeding and clothing your wife, so you're a provider, and that's one of the things that's normally in the wedding ceremony. Now today, the world is based on two income families, at least in our environment, and there's not anything directly wrong with that, but I would hope that most people wouldn't start out, young people, most don't have too many here to talk to about that, but most young people think about starting out a family as two income families and remaining that through life. Two income families are probably not a great idea unless one of those incomes is earned in the home when you have little children. When you have little children, somebody needs to be with those children. I hope that we don't just accept society's premise and start from the basis that, well, we just both have to work in order to be able to afford what we want, and therefore the children will have to suffer. You should strive to have a parent home when you have small children, and then lots of times, of course, when they start to school, people will be able to go out to work during the day in various ways to work around that factor. But just a word of counsel and advice from long, hard experience. It's a whole lot better if you can have one parent in the home when you have small children. You can't always do that, but in our society, sometimes it's built against us. Number 7 is effective communication, and I have all the way to 10, so I better hurry here. I will shorten this. Number 7, effective communication is a key factor in any successful marriage. You should not have entered into marriage without a lot of time to talk, on the phone, person to person, text, even write the old-fashioned letter if necessary. Godly families know each other well enough to communicate effectively, and they know each other well enough because they communicate effectively. Don't stop talking when you get married. Counseled a few people over the years who had a lot of fun and got along fine while they were dating, and after they got married, one of them quit talking. Doesn't work very well. If you're going to talk, you better be prepared to talk the rest of your life and do a lot of listening at the same time. By the way, the strong, silent husband, we often hear about the strong, silent husband is often a strong, selfish husband, because it can be hard work to talk sometimes. It can be hard work to listen sometimes in a sincere way, but it has to be done. And that can be true if one mate's an introvert and one's an extrovert. Sometimes that's difficult. The introvert doesn't always want to talk. The extrovert wants somebody to listen. So you got to work together in those situations. And again, communication must be sincere and clear. Say what you mean and mean what you say. There are lots of things available in the world, like discussions of love languages and personality profiles and differences, to help us understand the way other people are. But those must always be strained through God's Word and not take precedence. Resolving problems comes under communication and is a critical form of communication. And again, you start with the biblical instruction. And even in marriage, you go to your brother in that sense and deal with the issues that come up. Number 8, resisting the wiles of Satan and his world. Resisting the wiles of Satan and his world, godly marriage partners will be alert to the deceitfulness of Satan, who would like to destroy this image of Christ in the church. Satan's not asleep. He knows that marriage is one of the ways we understand God, so he'd love to destroy it. Husbands and wives must put each other first before any other human being, second only to God. Husbands and wives come first. Even service to the church. should not interfere very often with the priorities of taking care of each other. In fact, should never prevent taking care of each other, but sometimes we get engaged in serving others and serving in the church, and it does put a little bit of sacrifice on the rest of the family, but that's okay. The sacrifice can be shared. But we can't use as an excuse, I'm serving the church, to neglect family. Don't ever let down your guard. Don't ever compromise with that truth. Don't ever ignore God's law. Serving the church is not an excuse for failing your mate. In fact, we have long taught in the church, even to the ministry, that the priorities are God, family, then church. Even those of us employed in the ministry have to recognize that our family often has to be tended to before we have a base and a context in which to serve the church. Number 9, seeking wise counsel, mentioned earlier. Seeking wise counsel. When and if problems or serious questions arise, seek wise counsel, starting with the ministry. In some cases, your parents. Others you might go to for various reasons, knowing their capacity to counsel you. But that is not the same as just gossip or spilling your guts, as we say. Do not go to friends and brethren and accuse your mate of anything, ever. Don't go to friends and brethren and accuse your mate of anything. Don't fall into the trap of sharing your personal dislikes and conflicts with others. That can only be done in a confidential counseling process where neither mate is coming away scarred and tarred by the idea that they are the only one who's having a problem. Discussions like that should be kept private except in an acceptable counseling process. They're not to be shared among the brethren. And remember that a key element of your judgment before God is how you treat your mate, your closest neighbor. You know, we know that we're to love our neighbor as ourselves, and our mate is our closest neighbor. Notice 1 John chapter 4, verse 20. 1 John chapter 4. You thought I'd forgotten about the Bible, didn't you? 1 John chapter 4. Talked about this before, but it's a very important principle. If someone says, verse 20, if someone says, I love God and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? So God tells us to love God with all our heart and mind. And then he says, well, if you can't love your brother, why should I think you're going to love God? If we can't love our mate, how are we going to love other people? Now again, does that preclude all problems in marriage? Does that preclude marriages ever having serious problems or even coming apart? No, there can be love and still have circumstances come up that cannot be dealt with. But it would appear from this verse to me that loving your wife or your husband, who is your own flesh, would be obvious. If we have to love our brother to prove that we love God, we certainly must love our mate to prove that we love God. So again, I say our judgment is largely how we treat our mate. Number 10, and the last point I want to make for you, number 10, is being teachable. Being teachable. The surest way to end up wrong is to always be right. Right? The surest way to end up wrong is to always be right. That just generally doesn't work. We have to be able to admit when we're wrong and accept correction and guidance, both from our mate and others, back to submitting ourselves one to another. Marriage is an everyday close relationship, and we will make mistakes. For one thing, we haven't tamed the tongue, according to James, and most of us haven't accomplished that yet. It's a point he makes as a matter of principle that we will never be perfect because we haven't bridled the tongue. It appears that that's the last thing we'll have to conquer. And so we will even sin against a mate from time to time, but an attitude of humility and willingness to learn and grow should always be evident in a godly family. So we must be teachable. So whether you're new to marriage or whether you've been married 70 years, I'll up the ante, or thinking about marriage in the future, I hope you will evaluate yourself, your mate, and any potential marriage in the light of these factors. Because this that I've just given you is, at least in the broadest general terms,